Welcome to the Sleepy Time Grammar Podcast, presented by Dragonfly Editorial. If you don't know Dragonfly, we're a B2B content agency. That's a fancy way of saying we write things, edit things, and design things. But our real goal is to take stress off of our customers' shoulders and help them lead a more relaxing work life. That leads us to the Sleepy Time Grammar Podcast. In this podcast, we're going to talk about some of the things we love. Parts of speech, grammar rules, literature, language, and writing conventions, all in the most relaxing way possible. You can listen along while you're doing your creative work, doing laundry, washing the dishes, or relaxing on the couch. And if you happen to fall asleep, all the better. But there's no pressure to sleep. This is your time to relax. Let your cares drift away and let them be replaced by the wonderful world of words. Episode 1, all about verbs. So let's start with the basics. What in the world is a verb? To hear that, we're going to turn to our friendly neighborhood dictionary. That's Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, found on the World Wide Web at m-w.com. So what does Merriam-Webster tell us? They say that verbs are words that show an action, like sing, run, or play. They're an occurrence, like to develop, or a state of being, like to exist. They note that almost every sentence requires a verb. The basic form of a verb is known as its infinitive. The forms call, love, break, and go, for example, are all infinitives. Next up, they note that almost all verbs have two other important forms called participles. Participles are forms that are used to create several verb tenses. Those are forms that are used to show when an action happened. And they can also be used as adjectives. The present participle always ends in ing. For example, calling, loving, breaking, or going. Now note, there's also a kind of noun called a gerund that's identical in form to the present participle form of a verb. The verb's past tense usually has the same ed form as the past participle. For many verbs, however, the past tense is irregular. An irregular past tense is not always identical to an irregular past participle. For example, called and loved, but broke or went. And then finally, we'll talk about the two main types of verbs, transitive and intransitive. We're not going to talk about that right now, but we'll get into that later. So we've talked so far about a very straightforward definition of what a verb is. Now we're going to go to a more lyrical discussion of verbs. And for this, I turn to a fantastic book called The Elements of Expression, Putting Thoughts into Words. And this is written by a gentleman named Arthur Plotnick. Arthur was a photographer, journalist, author, and librarian. He was the editor of American Libraries magazine for years and worked for the American Library Association for over 20 years. The book that we're talking about today, The Elements of Expression, as well as his book, The Elements of Editing, were Book of the Month Club selections back in the day when Book of the Month Club was absolutely the thing. So, what does Arthur Plotnick tell us about verbs? He calls verbs power boosters. And here's what he has to say. Verbs power sentences. Energetic verbs rocket them. In expressing the nature of things, we can tell what they are, what qualities they have, or we can show what they do or do to something. The doing is usually more forceful, and it is done with action verbs. Notice at what point this little sequence springs to life. She was hungry. She knew of a place nearby. She had money. Soon she was served. She attacked the meatloaf, bloodied it with catsup, and wolfed it down. The verbs attacked, bloodied, and wolfed introduce dynamic energy, partly through their associations with action, fierce action. Action verbs produce force, especially action verbs that can be sensed. As used here, the action verbs are also what we call transitive verbs, because they act upon something, the poor meatloaf, which helps project force. Now, this is a very interesting analogy. Arthur says, think of a sentence's subject as a mass. Something has to move it. A physics-like formula can remind us to harness the power of the verb. E equals SV squared. In other words, energy equals the subject times the verb squared, or the subject animated by a big verb. Now here he gives us another example of a paragraph turned lively and powerful by its use of verbs. Here we go. She pulverized the windshield. He howled. Don't slobber, she told him. Broken glass festooned the bucket seats. He snapped out a handkerchief, swathed a glass fragment in it, thrust it at her. She winced. They hurled insults, shattered every bond between them, and plunged into frothing silence. Not all subject mass moves so unpleasantly, Arthur notes. He says that verbs release positive force as well. Walt Whitman, for example, elevates the whole mass of humankind in his Song of Myself, written in 1855, with such energetic verbs as souse, swag, unrumple, draggle, rock, dash, graft, chant, surge, dote, scoot, exude, suffuse, whirl, wrench, dab, adorn, dilate, girdle, straddle, jet, buoy, whiz, bag, strew, fling, until finally, and he quotes directly from Song of Myself, I depart as air, I shake my white locks at the runaway sun, I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags. So these are wonderful illustrations of how verbs create action in our language, create action in our sentences, and paint a picture for us of what's really going on in a situation. So, one thing I'd like to talk about next is active versus passive voice. And what's the difference? Because this is a critical way that verbs are used to give a completely different sense of what happens in a situation. So we're going to turn back quickly to our beloved Merriam-Webster. Again, that's at m-w.com. And see what they have to say about the difference between active and passive voice. Here's what they say. In English class, we are taught the difference between active and passive voice. The active voice asserts that the person or thing represented by the grammatical subject performs the action represented by the verb. In contrast, the passive voice makes the subject, the person or thing acted on or affected by the action represented by the verb. So they give us an example of active voice versus passive. Here's a sentence in active voice. Jerry knocked over the lamp. In passive voice, we could say, the lamp was knocked over by Jerry. Now, Merriam-Webster notes that both sentences describe the same action taking place. Jerry technically making contact with the lamp and causing it to fall over. And the first sentence makes Jerry the subject, and the second makes the lamp the subject. Now, here's my editorial take on this. The active voice gives the subject agency. It's clear who did the action. That dadgum Jerry knocked over the lamp. No two ways about it. The passive voice puts a little distance between what happened and who did it. The lamp was knocked over by Jerry. That suggests that maybe Jerry wasn't really at fault. Maybe he just happened to be walking by and bumped into the lamp. So there's a very distinct difference in tone between active and passive voice. Now, a lot of our style guides really bring up the difference between active and passive voice very clearly. So, for an example, we're going to look at the concise rules of APA style. And APA, if you don't know, stands for the American Psychological Association. And they produce a style guide that guides people who are preparing articles for publications in many professional journals that use the APA style. So here's what the APA guide says about verbs. And this is their recommendation for people who are writing, again, for publications that use APA style. So APA notes that verbs are vigorous, direct communicators. That kind of sounds like what we heard from Arthur Plotnick a little bit earlier. And APA calls for writers to use the active rather than the passive voice, and to select tense and mood carefully. So, for example, they provide a couple illustrations of different sentences in active versus passive. So here's the preferred style. We conducted the survey in a controlled setting. And this is the version that's not preferred, and it's in the passive voice. The survey was conducted in a controlled setting. So again, you can tell in the active version, it emphasizes the agency of the people taking the action. We conducted the survey. We did that deliberately, actively. Whereas in our passive voice example, it's like the survey was conducted in a controlled setting. Now, this is very interesting as well, because in this passive voice version, it's not clear who conducted the survey. We just say that the survey was conducted in a controlled setting. And you can see that in this case, the passive voice can be used, dare we say, somewhat nefariously to obscure who the actor was in any given situation. So APA goes on a little bit about passive voice, and here's what they say. The passive voice is acceptable in expository writing and when you want to focus on the object or recipient of the action rather than on the actor. For example, the speakers were attached to either side of the chair. Emphasizes the placement of speakers, not who placed them, which in this situation is kind of irrelevant. The speakers are the important point, not who attached them to the chair. So we can see from that example that there is a place for passive voice. It's when you want to focus on the object or the recipient of the action, rather than on who actually did it. In the same vein, they say, give the example of the president was shot. That emphasizes the importance of the person shot, rather than who actually took the action. So now we're going to take a little jaunt from American English over to Canadian English. Dragonfly, we're located in the United States, but our customers are actually all around the world. So sometimes we're editing for American English, sometimes for UK English, or sometimes for Canadian English, which, believe it or not, all have distinct differences in editorial style and terminology that's relevant in all those different nations. So I'm going to show you something interesting from a book called Editing Canadian English. It's a guide for editors, writers, and everyone who works with words in Canada. And this is published by the Editors Association of Canada, which is a fantastic group. They are a bilingual organization, and they promote professional editing as a key component in any successful communication strategy. They're a membership organization, very similar to ACES, the Society for Editing, here in the United States. And they have members that are in corporate, technical, government, not-for-profit, academic, and publishing sectors. And this book of theirs, Editing Canadian English, is super useful for anybody who's working in English for Canada. So this is something I found really interesting in their book. They have a section that says nouns or verbs, and it talks about a striking difference between French and English. This is something that English editors should be aware of, and it's the propensity of the French language to use nouns where English would normally and naturally use verbs. So, for example, I'm going to show you some examples of a phrase in French, the literal translation of it, and then how we would normally do that in English. So in French, we have a phrase, réaliser la traduction. The translation of that literally is to carry out a translation, with translation being a noun. But the preferred English form of that would be simply to translate, a pure, straight-up verb. Another example in French is to manger un repas. The literal translation is to eat a meal. But in English, the preferred form would just be to eat or to dine. And then finally, they give the example of to faire de la transcription. And you guys are going to have to forgive me for my French pronunciation. That means literally to make a transcription. But in English, we would simply say to transcribe. So this is a very interesting difference between French and English. And when we're editing in English, we tend to cut out phrases like to carry out a translation and simply simplify that to a word like translate. So when we're working in French, it's important to know that that's not the convention there. It's more natural with certain phrases for the French language to use nouns, whereas in English, we would normally use verbs. Pretty interesting. So I'm going to turn now to another more lyrical description of verbs. And this is from the classic Elements of Style by Strunk and White. I actually have a lovely illustrated penguin edition. Simply says, hello, on the inside cover. And it has beautiful images painted by Myra Kalman, who is the illustrator for this version. Now, we know that there's questions about Strunk and White and its relevance in today's world of editing and writing. But there are some gems in here, and this is one of them. They say, write with nouns and verbs. That's the name of this section. And here's what it says. Write with nouns and verbs, not with adjectives and adverbs. The adjective hasn't been built yet that can pull a weak or inaccurate noun out of a tight place. This is not to disparage adjectives and adverbs. They're indispensable parts of speech. Occasionally, they surprise us with their power, as in, up the airy mountain, down the rushy glen. We daren't go a-hunting for fear of little men. The nouns mountain and glen are accurate enough, but had the mountain not become airy, the glen rushy, William Allingham might never have got off the ground with his poem. In general, however, it is nouns and verbs, not their assistants, that give good writing its toughness and color. For our final resource today, we're going to turn to one of my most beloved books. It's Garner's Modern English Usage, and it's written by Brian A. Garner. Who is this gentleman? Well, let me tell you. Brian Garner is a lexicographer, a grammarian, a law professor, and a reference book author. He's been writing professionally about English usage for more than 4 decades. The book that we're looking at today is the 5th edition of this volume, and it comes in at a whopping 1,276 pages. So this is probably the biggest book in my reference shelf. Garner's books have influenced not just the fields of editing and writing, but also the legal world. The fancy term for that is jurisprudence and legal drafting. He's a big advocate for plain English and plain spoken writing in the legal world. I think that's a cause we can all get behind. Oh, he also wrote one of my very other favorite books of all time. It's the Harvard Business Review Guide to Better Business Writing. I have used this resource from day one in my work at Dragonfly. It's a masterclass in how to write plain, spoken, clear, powerful prose. So let's see what Mr. Garner has to say about verb tenses in his book. He provides us with a table. And this table shows the basic tenses in English with the verb to be conjugated. Now, we talked before about tenses show the time that a verb takes place. And so we'll start using the verb to be in the present tense. That means something that's happening right now. So, first person singular is I am. Second person singular, you are. And third person singular, he is. Now, if we look at the plural form in present tense, we have first person, we are. Second person, you are. And third person, they are. So now we'll jump to the past tense. And for these, I won't call out first, second, or third person. I'll just tell you what the different verb expressions are. So here we are in past tense. We have I was, you were, and she was. We've got we were, you were, and they were. Then we've got our future tense, what we're going to do coming up. I will be, you will be, and he will be. We will be, you will be, and they will be. So it's a little bit interesting. For the future tense, we see that the verb forms are all the same. That's different than we were in the present tense when the verb forms changed. For example, I am, but you are, and he is. Okay, so now we'll jump down to what's called the present perfect tense. And this is a tense that indicates something that's been ongoing for a period of time. And for this, we have I have been, you have been, and she has been. We've got we have been, you have been, and they have been. So again, just like with future tense, we see that the verb forms are all in line with each other now. An example of present perfect tense is what I'm doing right now. I have been talking to you for about the past 20 minutes. And I'm really happy to be talking to you, by the way. Let's jump in now to past perfect tense. Now, this describes something that you had been doing in the past, but you're no longer doing. So our verb tenses are I had been, you had been, and he had been. We had been, you had been, and they had been. So, for example, when I'm home tonight, curled up in bed reading a book, I could tell my daughter, I had been recording the podcast earlier today, but I think that's the last time I'll do that. Now, don't fret. This isn't really the last time I'm going to do that. This is just an example. So now we come to future perfect tense. Boy, these get really complicated. Let's see what this looks like. We've got I will have been, you will have been, and she will have been. We will have been, you will have been, and they will have been. So this is such a weird tense. An example of that is, I will have been president of Dragonfly Editorial for 20 full years as of next year. It's a tense that references the past and somehow also references the future. Now, all of the tenses we've talked about so far are in what's called the indicative mood. But then we've got some that are in the subjunctive mood. And the subjunctive mood in present tense, it can indicate a suggestion or a requirement. So, for example, in the singular, we could say, there's a requirement that I be at work on time. That you be early for your piano lesson. That he be rigorous in slicking back his hair every single day. Why would somebody need to slick back their hair daily? I'm not sure, but that just came to me as an example. In the plural, we have that we be, that you be, or that they be. So then we've got something, a subjunctive mood that's in the past tense. And again, this is kind of a present and future reference. In the singular, we have if I were, if you were, or if he were. In the plural, if we were, if you were, and if they were. So subjunctive in this case is suggesting almost a conditional, a theoretical situation. If I were best friends with Kim Kardashian, I would be on the Cannes red carpet every single year. Now, I'm not really saying I wish I were friends with Kim Kardashian. That's just an example. And then our final subjunctive mood is called the past perfect tense. And this is giving a past reference, sort of a wistful tense. In the singular, we had, if I had been, if you had been, and if she had been. In the plural, if we had been, if you had been, and if they had been. So like I say, this is almost a regretful tense, looking back at what could have been if conditions were different. So that's a wrap on episode 1 of Sleepy Time Grammar, presented by Dragonfly Editorial. We hope that you'll like and subscribe to this podcast in whatever app you like. Spotify, Apple Music, Pocket Casts, you name it. Our producer for this podcast is Clock Tower Media, and we are a production of Dragonfly Editorial. You can find us at dragonflyeditorial.com. Happy reading, happy editing, happy design, happy writing, and happy resting. We'll see you next time on Sleepy Time Grammar Podcast.